Coming up on this week's Book Show, Jane Smiley is the author of numerous novels, including 1,000 Acres, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize. Most recently, The Last 100 Years trilogy, Some Luck, Early Warning, and Golden Age. Her latest novel is Perestroika in Paris, about a racehorse who escapes and takes on the streets of the City of Light. Jane Smiley on this week's Book Show. Welcome to The Book Show, a celebration of reading and writers. I'm Joe Donahue. Jane Smiley is the author of numerous novels, including 1,000 Acres, which was awarded the Pulitzer Prize, and most recently, The Last 100 Years trilogy, Some Luck, Early Warning, and Golden Age. Her latest novel is Perestroika in Paris, a novel. Paris, short for Perestroika, is a spirited racehorse at a racetrack west of Paris. Well, one afternoon at dusk, she finds the door of her stall open and, being a curious filly, wanders all the way to the City of Light. She's dazzled and often mystified by the sights and sounds and smells around her, but she isn't afraid. But how long can a runaway horse stay undiscovered in Paris? How long can a boy keep her hidden and all to himself? Jane Smiley's new novel is an adventure that celebrates curiosity, ingenuity, and the desire of all creatures for true love and, yes, freedom. It's a great pleasure to welcome Jane Smiley to this week's Book Show. Always wonderful to speak with you. Thank you.
Oh, thank you.
Give us a sense of how this particular story came to you. Anyone who knows you, anyone who has read you at any length, knows your love of horses. So what brought you to this particular story?
Well, I first thought of it. I realized recently it was 2010. I had Perestroika. She's my mare now. She was my filly then. She was at that point about 5 years old, and I was riding her, and I was enjoying her a lot. And I happened to be in Paris, and I happened to visit the stables of an American woman who trains racehorses in France, and then came back and went to the Place du Trocadéro, which is on the west side of the Seine, across from the Champ de Mars and the Eiffel Tower. It's up a steep hill, and it's a really beautiful area, and I was quite struck by the area. And we were eating onion soup, of course. It was totally delicious. And I thought, wouldn't that be fun if a horse escaped from the racetrack and got into Paris? And I thought, oh, what a crazy idea that is. But of course, I couldn't stop thinking about it. I was already working on the trilogy, and I knew that I couldn't pause, really, in my work on the trilogy. But I did write a few things down, and then after I was done with the trilogy, I came back to it over and over to try and fiddle with it and see how I could make it believable. And it was a lot of fun. I enjoyed it.
So let's talk about the believability, because what is so charming about the book is the cast of characters that you include. And these are other wonderful creatures that Paris engages with. Give us a sense of the cast of characters that we meet.
I figured she needed a dog, and we had a perfect dog for this, our German short hair pointer named Frida, who's our dog. And she is a big, beautiful, athletic dog. But maybe because she was a German short hair pointer, she had a sense of existential despair about her. She loved to run around. She loved to go to the beach. She loved to do a lot of things. But when she was lying in her chair, her head would droop, and she would look like she was remembering sad things. And it was fun to watch her and notice how her personality was sort of shaped, seemed different from the other dogs that we had. So there was Paris. There was Frida, excuse me. And then when I was in Paris, of course, I noticed that there were plenty of ravens, and the area around the Eiffel Tower used to be different than it is now. I don't even know if the ponds are still there, but there were ponds, and there were birds in the ponds. So I thought it'd be fun to put a couple of mallards in. And I also looked at the houses that were along the two sides of the Champ de Mars, and they looked like they were quite old. And so I thought, there was one with a huge amount of brush over the fence so that you couldn't see into the yard. And I thought, there's another possibility there. So it was really fun. It was fun to do the research and to walk around and to taste all the pastries and, try the restaurants and all the things you have to do. And so they just sort of came to me, and the human characters the same way. They just sort of came to me. And it was fun. It was like putting together an amusing puzzle and then looking at what you have put together and say, that's pretty cool.
Because it comes off like a buddy comedy almost, right?
Maybe. I don't even know what that is, but
well, it's a character that you care about who comes in contact with other characters that you care about, and they're rummaging around this really cool area in the shadow of the Eiffel Tower, and it's just charming.
Oh, thank you. Yeah, I knew it had to be in the winter, because if it was in the summer, too many people would be around. But since in Paris, because of the latitude, night comes pretty early after November. Mm. And so I knew it had to be in the winter, and that there had to be a place for Paris, the horse, to hide. And that made it potentially more doable. Let's put it that way.
And the neighborhood isn't really all that touristy, even though the Eiffel Tower is nearby. People come and then they leave. The neighborhood lends itself to those characters being able to roam.
Yes, it's a wonderful neighborhood. I actually like walking around that neighborhood a lot, but it's not the normal neighborhood. It's a neighborhood where people live rather than a neighborhood that has lots and lots of visitors and tourists.
There are rats, there are ducks, there are ravens, and I'm interested because both the horse and the dog that you mentioned have personal connections. So were there names that you had to come up with that didn't have a connection to your particular menagerie?
Well, the most important thing about names in a book is that they have to be distinct from one another. And so you can't have Hal and Harold, be two different characters. So I had to come up with plausible French names for the animals that were distinct from one another, except for, the mallards. But I'm not going to talk about why I named them.
Okay, that's fine. Now,
I have to say, though, that the raven, Raoul, who is extremely knowledgeable, at least according to him, he does believe that this is mentioned in the book, he does believe that the mallards are reincarnations of a certain couple from a number of years ago who were kind of weird. And that's why they have those names.
When you think of, and I just want to go while we're on names, talk about the original naming of Perestroika. Paris is the is the name of the horse. Of course, we knew a lot. We've learned a lot about that word from Mikhail Gorbachev and others. So, what brought you to Perestroika?
Well, my Perestroika was her sire is the same as the sire of the horse in the book, Moscow Ballet. And so, when I was coming up with her name, I just thought that would be a nice, interesting name to give her. But she was immediately nicknamed Paris, P-A-R-A-S. So that's not a name that we called her. But lots of times when you are naming thoroughbreds, you have to link the name in some way to their sire and dam and then the previous relatives. So since her sire was Moscow Ballet, I thought that would be a fun name for her, Perestroika.
Jane Smiley is our guest. The name of her new book is Perestroika in Paris, a novel. When you are writing about horses, and I think I've told you this before, it's such a natural thing for you because you seem to have such a friendship and love for the species. Give me a sense of where that comes from. I believe in previous conversations with you, you have yourself labeled it as an obsession of sorts. What
Yeah.
brought you to that love of horses?
Well, my mother would have said it came out of nowhere. But, you know, the first time I remember being on a horse was when I grew up in Webster Groves, Missouri, and my mother worked at a newspaper, and so I spent the days with my grandparents. And on the road between my grandparents' house and my mom's apartment, there was a little pony ride that was a small maze. The ponies were at one end, and you'd go, and you could do this at night, too, because they would turn the lights on. And that was, in some ways, the most fun. Anyway, you'd stop at the pony ride, and they'd strap you in, and then they'd get you to trot about around the maze, maybe two or three times, maybe more. And I totally loved that. And then on TV, we got our first TV in 1956, and my grandparents also had a TV. And my favorite shows were the shows with horses in them, like Roy Rogers or My Friend Flicka, and I watched those shows avidly. And so that's where it clicked in. I learned to read and I read horse books. Occasionally my mom took me out for a trail ride somewhere. And, you know, I think she's mostly rolling her eyes and saying, I can't imagine. But we have this great story in our family from when my grandparents, and I think I heard this story pretty early, when my grandparents had a ranch in Idaho. They had cattle and they had horses. And one time my grandfather and his brother went out to bring the cattle in on a snowy night, and they realized that there was a big snowstorm coming in. And so they didn't think they could get back to the house in time. So they jumped off the horses and let the horses run free so the horses could stay warm by running free. And then they cuddled up together in a little dip in the ground and hoped for the best. Mm. And they did get covered in snow, apparently, but they also got home. So there were these kind of stories in our family. And, you know, how could I resist?
I remember the great animator Chuck Jones, who was responsible for many of the classic Bugs Bunny cartoons as well as the Roadrunner and Coyote. I remember him telling me once that there were rules that the animators had, and one of the rules was that Bugs always started out in the rabbit hole. Yes, he could end up on stage conducting an orchestra, but it had to begin in a perfectly logical place. I thought of that about Paris because Paris is not like yearning to be free and not escaping anything. The horse leaves really just out of curiosity, of wanting to learn more about this really cool place where she lives.
Well, you know, it's, we've all, anybody who's been doing horses for years knows that horses do sometimes get out of their stalls, and then they have different reactions to that. And Paris, my horse, did push her out of her stall a few years ago. I think it was me that left it unlocked, but all she did was walk down the aisle and look here and there. She didn't run away. She just explored a little bit. And so I think that's just the way she is. She's when I lead her around, and she's always looking here and looking there, not as if she's scared or anxious, but just because she just wants to see stuff. And so, yes, it's a fairly common thing for someone to leave the stall door unlatched by mistake. And then whatever the horse does after that is totally up to the temperament of the horse. And some wouldn't even leave. Some horses like the stall, but some horses are curious, and some horses are dying to get out.
But your characters, these critters, if you will, talk about this. They talk about freedom. they talk about ownership, of what it is like to be owned. That's fascinating. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure that, well, why not? Let's say that horses have a lot more intelligence and ability to communicate than we give them credit for. I had to laugh the other day. A friend of mine was on her horse, and I said, may I give her a cookie? And before the friend said anything, the horse nodded her head up and down. So, yeah, maybe that's just a coincidence, but, you know, she sure seemed like she knew what I was saying.
The other thing that I find just beautiful about this book is there's really no villain, right? I mean, there's no bad guy in the book. It simply is sort of the world as it is that these animals are navigating, that provide the challenges, if you will.
Well, yes, I think that I didn't want to put a bad guy in. At one point, my editor said, why don't you put a bad guy in? And I went through it and looked at it, and I didn't want a bad guy. Life is the bad guy. A lot of the characters are dealing with, you know, major or minor life crises. So they don't need a bad guy in order to be a little nervous or a little worried. They just have to negotiate or navigate through what is the normal stuff that we all have to get through. And so, no, I didn't want a bad guy.
There are the human that we attach ourselves to in this book is an 8-year-old boy. Tell us about the creation of that character and his love of Paris, and as I mentioned in the introduction, of wanting to keep that love and that horse all to himself.
Well, he's an isolated boy. He doesn't go to school. He lives with his great grandmother in a big house, and he's a smart kid, and he has taught himself to read, and he's read horse books. He has noticed the horse in the Champ de Mars, because he's not far from where she is, and he's noticed her. And in a lot of ways, he's like I was when I was his age, just obsessed with a horse, wants the horse, wants to figure out a way to at least get close to the horse. I'm not saying that when he first thinks about it, he wants to claim the horse. But I remember in the horse books that I read as a kid, one of them was called Silver Birch. And it was about a girl who's obsessed with getting a horse, and she lives in Wisconsin, and there happens to be a horse running around in the woods near her farm, and she lures the horse into her area and claims the horse. And I guess when I was 8 years old, I thought that was possible. When you're 8 years old and you read books, you think, oh, this must all be true. And so that's how I see Etienne. He's an interesting boy, and I enjoyed him. He's a very caring child, and he's mature in a lot of ways because he has to deal with and care for his great-great-grandmother, who's in her 90s.
I'm sure you've been told this before, but that character, along with the animals and this telling, which takes place in 2008, is lovely because it comes at a time where everything is political, everything seems polarized, and yet none of that exists here. This novel looks to be a safe place, if you will. Did you feel that way in writing it, that was your respite from living the world that we're all living?
Well, no, because it took me so long to go, you know, I took me so long to write it and then get it published. I had no idea what was coming. I mean, what I say about the trilogy, I finished the trilogy and published it published the last one in 2015.
Right.
And when I was working on the last 4 years in the trilogy, which is my first step into quote-unquote science fiction, I had to write about things that I speculated were going to happen between 2016 and 2020, but I had no idea what they were going to be. And I tried to make them as scary as possible, but I didn't make them as scary as they turned out to be. So in some ways, that was a failure of my imagination of crisis and conflict. I knew bad things were going to probably happen, but I had no idea what was going to happen or what really happened, and it's what is happening right now. So, you know, I guess I've always been an optimist, and the Perestroika in Paris is a kind of example of my characteristic optimism.
Mm. I want to ask you, I know we've talked about several of your past books in previous conversations, and I don't believe that I have ever talked to you about my favorite of your novels, which is a satire about academia, and that is entitled Moo. It's a great book,
yes,
with a great cover.
Thank you.
And it is wonderfully satiric. And you are very good at that form. This book is more of a fairy tale, but it is fascinating because there can be a satirical line to it as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I really loved writing Moo. And I taught at Iowa State at the time, which was a land-grant university. And I knew that every university has a kind of political aspect, that it has all kinds of people on the campus. But because of funding, especially corporate funding, universities can sort of change the world in a way that suits corporations rather than, let's say, the environment, which is the case in terms of farming in a lot of ways. But that was only one aspect of the university, and there were lots of characters. There were student characters. There were professional characters. There were also animal characters, or at least one animal character. Mm. I knew it was political, and I also heard that the president of the university at the time was terrified that I was going to be making fun of Iowa State. But that wasn't my goal. my goal was just to explore all aspects of university life in a funny but slightly satiric way. There was a character who was always trying to get corporate funding for various programs at the university. Mm. And he turned out to be the bad guy. Yes, that Moo had a bad guy in it.
Absolutely. Mm-hmm. And a wonderful bad guy. It was a great character, too.
And it wasn't the hog, either.
No. Let us talk. I want to maybe I'm going in the weeds here a little bit and picking apart something that you said earlier. But you were talking about in describing Perestroika and Paris as a puzzle. Do you look at all novels that you have done? You have been wonderfully prolific. Do you look at all of them as a different type of puzzle?
Oh, absolutely. I like to try new forms. I like to try things that I haven't done before. And that's probably because I like to read all kinds of books. And so I like to try, sometimes I'll be reading a certain type of book and I'll think, oh, this is a fun form. I should try this. When I first started out writing books, I knew that I wanted to write the Greenlanders. Because I'd been to Iceland, I'd heard about Greenland, I'd read all the Icelandic sagas. I knew in order to write a book like The Greenlanders, I had to learn how to do a plot. So I wrote Duplicate Keys as a murder mystery, just to learn how to do a plot. Mm. So once I'd tried all these forms, I knew I wanted to do an epic, I wanted to do a tragedy, I wanted to do a comedy, and I wanted to do a romance. And so once I'd tried all of those forms, I thought, okay, there's other forms that are so enjoyable, I should try them too. And I guess I was prepared to just go this way and that way. One of my friends who used to be an editor, book editor, said that my publisher has been extremely kind to me in letting me to jump around like that. And yeah, I agree.
So when you come to Knopf and say, I have a new novel and talking horses and a raven and ducks, and they don't bat an eye anymore, I would think, right? They're ready.
Not in front of me. You know, they might be doing it behind closed doors, but they're very good with me, and they help me figure out how to make it work. And so, yeah.
I don't know if you'll agree with this statement or not. I personally, there are authors that I love to go to because I know exactly what I'm going to get. And then there's authors like you that I love to go to because I have no idea what I'm going to get. They're both kind of cool, I think.
I agree.
The new book for you is absolutely delightful. It's Perestroika in Paris, a novel. It is published by Knopf. Jane Smiley, it's always a great pleasure to speak to you. I so enjoy our conversations. Thank you very much.
I do too. Thank you very much.
Be well. Thank you.
You too.
We enjoy hearing from our listeners about our shows. You can email us at book@wamc.org, and you can listen again to this or find past book shows via podcast or at wamc.org. Sarah LeDuc produces our program. Bookmark us for next week, and thanks for listening for The Book Show. I'm Joe Donahue.